I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. B-Cycle is the latest bike-sharing project to hit the U.S. Behind the project is Alex Bogeski, principal with the creative firm Crispin Porter Bogeski. We'll find out how B-Cycle works and why easy access to a bike causes big drops in traffic congestion. And we'll talk with Elliot Brown about Springboard Forward, an organization that inspires people to develop a long-term vision for their career mobility. Springboard Forward helps transform the lives of entry wage workers with this unique form of career development. All that plus the latest news from PlanEdison and our City Views commentator Walker Smith coming up on today's Smart City right after this news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. The creative firm Crispin Porter Bogeski is known for such memorable ad campaigns as the I'm a Mac, I'm a PC commercials and the cheeky anti-SUV Mini Cooper ads. But Alex Bogeski has turned his eye toward the world of bike commuting with his latest project, a bike sharing system called B-Cycle. Alex, cycling seems to have exploded in America's major cities. What's behind the sudden enthusiasm for biking?
When gas prices went up to $4 a gallon, we definitely saw a big, big spike. I don't know if explosion is quite it. And if you're in the bike business, it's actually been a tough time. When gas prices came back down and the recession hit, it hasn't been a great time for the bike business.
Is that possibly because everyone has one?
I think it's a combination of things. One is it's cycling over time became really specialized. And the sense is you needed special shorts and special shoes and all this sort of gear. And the cities have been designed so that most cities, anyway, are not particularly bike-friendly. So, at times it's a little scary, depending on where you need to ride.
Tell me about B-Cycle and how it works.
Well, B-Cycle is patterned after the Parisian bike share system. One of my friends came back from Paris a while ago, and he was all excited about how bike sharing had kind of changed his experience with the city. And not only was cool and convenient, but he actually felt like he saw things in Paris that he wouldn't have seen otherwise. And we live in Boulder, so we sort of hatched this idea to figure out, well, what's the American version of that, and could we bring that to Boulder? So we started talking to people at the mayor's office, and through that process, actually met some other people who had the same goals. And the first folks we met were from Humana, and they had been having similar conversations, and we got put together. And then through the process, a little further along, we got put together with Trek, who makes the largest maker of bicycles in America. And we put together this joint venture to try to bring this concept to the U.S.
Trek makes sense as a partner. What was Humana's interest?
Well, I think Humana understands that the bike is probably solves so many things. It's the greatest piece of exercise equipment. We all have them in our garages. The problem is, though, that half the time they've got a flat, the chain came off. So your own bike isn't always there when you need it and may have mechanical issues. So bike sharing makes a lot of sense because it's sort of this magical bike that is there when you need it and goes away when you don't.
I love the idea of the magical bike. You sold me right there, the magical bike that's always ready to go. Okay, so describe it in more detail. You tested the concept at the Democratic National Convention in Denver last year. What did you learn? I presume that was the first test of B-Cycle.
That was, and one of the things that we just keep learning over and over is just the enthusiasm. So many people are excited about the idea. So many people want to help. Everywhere we go, we run into people who want to bring this to their community, and it's been very encouraging. And, what we thought was an idea, again, it started as an idea, can we do this in Boulder, has become potentially something that we'd like to see in cities all across America.
You said that people have been telling you to bring it to their city, and I noticed on your website that you invite people to invite B-Cycle to their cities, and then you will even offer to send a message to the mayor to let him or her know about the desire to have B-Cycle in the community. Which cities have generated the most letters?
Well, it's been interesting because we sort of developed B-Cycle not for the large municipalities, but for the mid-size. And the reason why is the Parisian model was done by an outdoor advertising company, and they did it in trade for the rights to all the outdoor advertising locations in Paris. So big cities can potentially do deals like that, right? And so we thought, but a municipality like Boulder, they can't do that because, well, Boulder doesn't have outdoor advertising. So there's nothing to trade. They needed a turnkey system that they could just purchase and put in. But what we found is really most U.S. cities are not in a position to do that kind of trade. It's so fractured who owns what. And so our system has become really attractive to pretty much everybody. And in fact, it's been the big cities that tend to be leading the way right now. So, you know, New York and Boston are both in RFP, which means they're taking proposals from companies. L.A. and Chicago and San Fran are considering looking at information from companies right now. And then we've got a lot of, outside of that RFP process, there's a lot of municipalities that have just come to us individually and said, hey, we want to bring this to our town.
So if you're not using the outdoor advertising revenue model, what is the revenue model?
Well, you know, it's one of the things that we're still trying to figure out, because you go into it with some concepts of how you think a municipality might want to pay for this and operationalize it, but they're all coming to it with a different idea. So we're having to be very modular in what you can get from us. You could potentially buy just the equipment. You could partner with a private company to sponsor, and a lot of private companies are interested in that as well. You can partner that way, and then we stay involved with the maintenance. So there's any number of ways that it can actually happen.
Are companies bringing a revenue model to this? I mean, could New York or Boston say, and I say revenue model, I mean, that may be too fancy a term, would they say, we think this is important enough, we'll pay for it?
Oh, absolutely. Certain cities are taking government funding and paying for portions of it like that. Some are looking for matching contributions from the community. Others are looking for help from private industry. And, it's any combination of that. But it's really affordable. And what we found is, and this has been surprising too, it is affordable enough. And what you get in terms of profile and the ability to do something great for the community, it's actually really attractive to companies to just take this on and sponsor it.
Yeah, so without the outdoor advertising, the bikes themselves, and the fact that you're doing it and the publicity that comes with it becomes the advertising.
Absolutely. The bikes themselves are advertising. And you know, to whatever degree you want to advertise, I think most people that we've talked to want to be very subtle with the branding and really look at it as a sponsorship. This bike brought to you by.
Yeah, yeah.
And really does everything that they need it to do. But for $2 million, you can put a system into a city and get probably much, much more exposure than you could with $2 million worth of outdoor advertising.
And $2 million would buy you what size system? How many bikes? How many locations?
About a 500 bike system.
Mm-hmm. And how many locations?
That would be about 40 stations.
I see.
So Denver is doing piloting about 700 bikes with 50 stations this April on Earth Day, April 22nd.
What makes a good location for a bike sharing stand? Not as a city, but the actual location. Where do you put these things?
It's a good question. One of the places that you would put them is you'd put them in parking spaces, and so they're designed to fit in parking spaces and be modular and be able to go into a single space or multiple spaces. And that's an important part of the design. The notion is that you'd have less car traffic and you'd need less parking spaces. So that makes sense. They're also designed so they can go on the sidewalk. And, you know, in designing something that potentially is on the sidewalk, you've got considerations of pass-through. So, some of the early designs had sort of a horizontal bar. You know, that wasn't ideal, because it doesn't allow pedestrian pass through. We've been continuing to redesign, so the system 2.0 actually allows for that. But a good location, I think, is enough density that you don't worry about where the next stand is. They need to be close enough that, and so we work with the city to develop a plan where we're not going to put these things in such a way that the rider is worried, well, what if I get over on this part of town? Lodo in Denver is the perfect spot because it's very self-contained, and you want a fair amount of density. You don't want to spread them out too much.
You tested the system in Denver during the Democratic National Convention. Now you're actually introducing the system with 700 bikes?
What we tested in Denver was the concept of, do people like to have the ability to grab a bike and see Denver? And overwhelmingly, they did, and it was really, it made the convention something that people enjoyed in ways that they wouldn't have otherwise, and managed traffic in ways that they probably didn't see. Paris has seen a 5% decrease in traffic, automotive traffic, since the installation, which is massive if you think about, how do you decrease traffic 5%?
Yeah, it really is.
But what they tested was not a system where anybody can walk up with a card, swipe their card, and check out a bike. That's a more sophisticated version, and that's what's going into Denver on Earth Day.
That's exciting.
Yeah, very exciting.
So why do you think Mayor Hickenlooper in Denver supports this? And I presume your support was coming from the mayor's office.
Yeah, absolutely. He's a visionary, and he has done a lot to support bikes. The infrastructure in Denver in terms of anybody riding a bike is quite good. And, what they've also seen in Europe is that as you put systems in, private ridership of bicycles goes up by as much as 50%, which is something you might not expect, but it habitualizes the concept of riding your bike. So you don't necessarily get a lift just from the bike sharing. You're actually getting a lift because you're creating a normalcy around riding your bike.
You and I have talked about this. We saw each other in San Francisco at the Turning the Tide conference, and I told you that a number of mayors I've talked to seem to love the idea of the cycles on the street, but they can't quite crack the problem of liability to their satisfaction. How do you handle liability?
That's not something that we've come up against yet, so that's a new one for me.
Okay. Well, that's good. I'm glad they're not raising that concern with you.
That hasn't been a big part of the concern, no.
And so who is liable for, let's say, injuries related to city-sponsored bike services, bike sharing?
I'm not sure. I would imagine that it'd be different by state. I moved out from Florida to Colorado, and Florida doesn't have any skate parks. It doesn't have skiing, but it couldn't have skiing because whatever the laws are there, they seem to be very different than Colorado. And Colorado has laws where if, you get hurt skiing, you probably aren't going to own Vail.
So it does you no good whatsoever to get hurt skiing.
It's not a great idea.
Got it. If you're just joining us, my guest is Alex Boguski, creator of the bike sharing program B-Cycle. Okay, so who uses B-Cycle? Who uses bike sharing? All ages? I mean, is there an... What's the demographic?
Statistically, it should be pretty much everybody. We know that 40% of all automotive trips are less than 2 miles. So a bicycle is pretty much the perfect vehicle for 40% of all trips that are made. And the other really, encouraging stat is 60% of emissions actually happen in the first 10 minutes of vehicle operation because it runs dirtier at the beginning. So it's appropriate for most, a large portion of the trips that are out there. And it does double duty in terms of cleaning things up.
Very interesting. What sort of trips will they use bike sharing for? If I'm carrying a backpack, do I have to be dressed a certain way? I mean, will people typically not, will women not get on a bike if they've got on a skirt? I mean, what does that look like?
Well, there's a bunch of questions there. One is the ergonomics of the bike, and you know, Trek spent a lot of time in the development of the bike. And what's interesting is, you know, the specs are it needs to fit people from 5 foot to 6'5", right? And if you've ever gone to the bike shop, that's usually not the same bike. That's a bunch of different bikes for a bunch of different people. So, you know, creating something that could span those shapes and sizes is a challenge. And then also having the pass through, so it's an easy bike to get on and off. And they've done all those things. And as well, it's got a big strong basket. It's a very overbuilt bike. It's geared, so it's easy to ride. And so it's appropriate to anyone over 5 foot.
What is the biggest challenge that you've encountered getting B-Cycle up and running?
I think the biggest challenge has been really in municipalities figuring out where they're going to find the funding. There's a lot of different models that we're dealing with, and the funding is obviously happening in some places, and other places they're struggling with where it's going to come from. You know, it's interesting. Walking and bikes represent right now 10% of the rideshare that's out there, and they get 1% of the funding. Buses represent 2% of all the rideshare, and they get 20% of the funding. So there are things that over time I think are going to adjust, as it's a new concept, and obviously it's got to go from zero funding to its share. Based on the cost of the systems, it won't be difficult once it's getting its fair share of funding. I think we'll see that the money is there.
Mm-hmm. And yet we don't provide people cars. We do provide buses, but they are shared. And so you're saying a bike is shared, not anyone's property. And there's an opportunity.
It's the magic bike.
It's the magic bike from a funding perspective as well. So look, if everything went perfectly, how quickly could you ramp this up?
That's probably a question that I don't have the answer to yet. We have, as one of the partners, we have Trek. They make 1 million bikes a year. I think if we had spectacular success with this, we're talking about putting in between 50 and 100,000 bikes over the next several years. So the capacity is there to get it done. Each municipality will have a different infrastructure that you'll need to work with. You know, our hope is that most of them have transportation cards that work across trains and buses. We would want to integrate that card into this system as well, so that, you know, this is as simple as possible. You want to make a system where it really transforms the city for visitors. So you want it to be very friendly for visitors, but visitors tend to clog up the system because they've got a credit card, they need to sign in. It's a longer process. If you're a member, it's an RFID reader, you just swipe your card and a bike unlocks. So, you know, everything's designed so that if there are visitors at the kiosk, they actually don't interrupt local commuters who can easily just go and check out their bike. I think the other thing that's been interesting about the process is it's just outrageously complicated. You know, as simple as you would think it might be at the beginning, it really is complicated to do it right.
When do you expect New York and Boston to make their decisions, since you say they have RFPs on the street now?
I don't know. I don't think that it's something that's going to happen overnight. It's going to take a little while. Minneapolis went into RFP, and we participated in that process and supposedly came in second. And since then, it's gone back into RFP because there were concerns about whether it would work with the company they selected. So It's a Wild West a little bit.
Well, the Wild West can be fun and wild, I guess.
It's wild, and a lot of good things happen.
Yeah. Well, Alex, thanks so much for being with us on Smart City.
It was fun. Thanks for having us.
Alex Bogusky is the creator of the bike sharing program B-Cycle and a principal at Crispin Porter Bogusky. If you want to have a look at the B-Cycle kiosk or find out how you can bring B-Cycle to your city, head to our website, smartcityradio.com. And now for the latest in the world of urban planning and design, we turn to Nate Berg of Plan Edison.
Some are calling it unrealistic. Others say it's the smartest move in the country. Whatever people want to think, the fact is that San Francisco's new recycling law is by far the strictest in America. Officials there just approved new standards that require residents and businesses to sort their waste into three bins: garbage, recyclables, and now compost. San Francisco is now the first city in the country to require that all food waste be separated into a compost bin, according to a recent article from the San Francisco Chronicle. It's part of a plan led by Mayor Gavin Newsom to bring the amount of material the city sends to landfills down to zero by the year 2020. That's an ambitious goal, one that many have criticized as being impossible to achieve. But the city and its board of supervisors are hopeful that the new recycling laws will at least nudge them closer to a zero-waste future. But in other parts of the country, waste is a big problem, especially since the implosion of the housing market. But it's not food scraps and beer cans that are troubling cities, it's wasted space. Cities across the country are blighted with entire neighborhoods that have been abandoned since the fall of the housing market and the ensuing recession, and many are scrambling to figure out what to do with them. One idea that's gathering support at the federal level is an all-out bulldozing, according to a recent article in the London Telegraph. Pioneered in the former industrial town of Flint, Michigan, the strategy for dealing with these empty and wasted spaces is to simply smash them, clear the land, and let it return to its natural pre-development state. 50 U.S. cities will be examined as possible sites for this bulldozing project, including Detroit, Philadelphia, Baltimore, and Memphis. Meanwhile, on roads and freeways across the world, seemingly unprovoked traffic jams are bringing drivers to a crawl. Even with clear roads and no impediments in sight, freeways just get jammed up. This phenomenon is known as a, quote, phantom jam, and a team of researchers from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology has developed a model that tries to make sense of these senseless backups. They've written out some advanced mathematical equations to help explain the congestion. According to a recent article from Science Daily, the research helps to determine how and under what conditions traffic jams will form, which are mainly related to a high density of cars. Researchers say their study could help traffic engineers and road designers to counteract traffic jams by improving density on the roads. And finally, prison is not exactly the place most people want to go. Here in America, more than 1% of the entire population is incarcerated, and many of them aren't in jail for the first time and are likely to go back. A lot of that recidivism, it turns out, may have to do with design. A recent article from the New York Times Magazine looks at a prison in Austria that emphasizes livability, comfort, and the dignity of the prisoners in its design. The result is what some are calling a luxury prison. But prison is prison, and nobody is particularly happy to be there. But unlike America's brutal big-box prisons, fewer of the inmates are likely to return. With more common areas where inmates can interact and nicer living facilities, the Austrian prison is being seen by some in the field as a more humane approach to dealing with prisoners. Because if you treat prisoners like people, once they get out, they're much more likely to act like people, not prisoners. For Planetizen, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is the assistant editor of Planetizen.com. Coming up after the break, we'll find out how Elliot Brown is transforming the lives of low-wage workers with the innovative career development program Springboard Forward. I'm Carol Coletta. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. While the fastest growing jobs in America are found in the service industry, many of those jobs don't pay a living wage. But my next guest, Elliot Brown, hopes to turn those jobs into stepping stones to a better career. Elliot is the founder of the program Springboard Forward, a unique form of career development that radically changes the way low-wage workers view their jobs. I ask Elliot how Springboard Forward is tackling the problem of low wages in the service industry.
Well, we've taken a very different approach to taking a look at this. It's true that we have the vast majority of jobs that sort of entry point jobs are low wage, and they're in industries like retail, where we have 13 million Americans working, mostly entry level. And the problem is that we know how to get people jobs. We don't know how to help them build careers. And we've been working on a strategy that is based on decades-old ideas that if you get somebody a job at the entry level, they'll work their way up the ladder. But the reality is that the jobs don't pay and haven't kept pace with the economy. And that I think a greater problem is that when you have a bottleneck and people cycling from job to job and living paycheck to paycheck, and they don't see light at the end of a tunnel, then they start to give up hope. And so we've created a career model that works with folks who are working at fairly low wages and helps them to craft a new vision for their future, and then helps them work toward it.
Are you turning low-wage jobs into jobs with a career path, or low-wage workers into people with a career path?
It's the latter. And the idea is that, you know, in the 21st century, career advancement rarely happens in a straight line. People in professional careers are taught to pursue their interests and their passions by building networks and finding their way toward employment that that they can be excited about. And when you're starting at jobs that, for example, in retail, that don't necessarily have a natural career path, we make the mistake of assuming that the goal is to try to move people up that ladder, when in fact the goal should be to leverage that job to build a future based on talent and aspiration.
Describe a career path. What does that mean?
Well, I think that's a funny question because, you know, if you think about, I started my career as an administrative assistant at a tech company, and I did not pursue a career in administration or in technology, in the technology industry. So, you know, for me, the career path was a series of interesting jobs that has led me to where I am today. And it's not a prescribed path. So I think the idea of career paths is really, in a lot of ways, an idea of the past.
So what takes its place?
Well, what takes its place is the individual pursuit of jobs that are interesting to you, and that in those jobs you think about what it is that you're trying to accomplish and where it is you want to go, and you head that direction. And where you end up is often very different from where you started. So just as an example, you know, you're working in a retail job in a customer service role. Well, it turns out that you're great at working with people. So as you're thinking about what you might want to do next, you realize, well, I'm great with working with people. I'd like to make more money, and maybe I'd like to be in a different kind of environment. So, you know, maybe the next job that comes your way is a job in a service role, but, you know, maybe it's at a university, at a bursar's office, or it's in a library, or it's in, you know, you can imagine all kinds of directions people can go. And from there, you know, you continue to build your networks and opportunities come your way. I mean, I think the idea that you can prescribe for people a career path, what we believe is that when you can tap into people's aspirations and their talents, that people will find jobs that get them excited, that those jobs will lead to other opportunities because they'll be excited about the job, they'll be engaged on the job, and they'll be recognized for the work that they're doing. And so their careers will advance, and the actual direction it will take, it could go in hundreds of different directions.
I've always thought, Elliot, that maybe people can't get jobs because they don't know what jobs are available. How do you help people think broadly about this and understand what may be out there for them in terms of jobs?
Well, you know, you talk to anyone in the career development field or anyone in human resources at a corporate level, they'll tell you that most of the jobs that people end up getting, they find through their networks. And that the better your network and the better you are at articulating what it is that you're looking for, the more likely that you will meet someone who says, you know, we have this opening. Are you interested? And it is true that over half the jobs that people get in the United States come through networks. They don't come through job boards or, you know, or some of the more traditional ways.
How do you help people build their networks?
We encourage people to think about what it is that they get excited about and to then think about who they could talk to who are doing those kinds of things that they find interesting and go and talk to them. An informational interview is one of the best ways to build a network and to find out what kinds of opportunities are out there. And so we, again, first tap into people's aspirations so that they can really talk about, you know, this is what where my talent is and this is what I'm excited about. And I'd love to find out more about what you do and what kinds of openings are available in this field. And that concept of an informational interview is what we tell people who graduate from college. We don't necessarily tell people in lower income communities.
It's hard to have a network without a network. So how do you help them think about where that first interview, that first contact might come from?
We tell them to start with who they know. And we tell them to think about, you know, do you know anyone that might know someone who is doing something in this area that you could talk to? And so you start with who you know and you say, look, this is what I'm interested in. I'm interested in a career that looks like this and that moves in this direction. Do you know anyone who's doing this kind of work? And they'll either say, you know what, you ought to talk to my friend Sally, or they'll say, you know, I don't, but I know exactly who will. And so we tell them, you know, you build a network outward from the people you know.
How do you get people to explore what they like to do? I'm reminded of What Color Is Your Parachute? I just saw recently the newest version of that book. And of course, it has seemingly hundreds of exercises that help you explore what you may be good at doing, what you may like to do, and what your ambitions are. How does Springboard Forward tackle that problem?
Well, we've taken a much more experiential approach than traditional career approaches. The concept is that we believe our clients know the answers. They may not have been able to completely articulate them, but we believe they know the answers. And so we ask them through a process that we call career mapping to identify the things that they're best at, the things where the places in their life or the times in their life where they have felt truly successful and where they were excited to get up in the morning to do those things. And so it's an 8-hour series of workshops that basically asks questions to people about the experiences they've had both in the work setting but also in their life in general, where they've had a chance to really tap into their talents, their interests, their passions, and at the end they have essentially a map. In fact, our career maps fold up like a roadmap. And then we use that map to help them create a plan.
Where do you find your clients?
So one of the unique things about our model is that because we are working with people who are already working, we've chosen to do our work in partnership with the businesses that employ folks. So we'll create a partnership with a retail organization, for example, and then we'll identify with that company employees who could benefit from having a chance to really explore their aspirations. So our clients actually come to us through the business partnerships that we have.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Elliot Brown. Elliot is the founder of the program Springboard Forward, an organization that inspires people to develop a long-term vision for their career mobility. Springboard Forward helps transform the lives of entry wage workers with this unique form of career development. What's in it for a retailer to engage a group of employees in Springboard Forward who may not put retail on their career map?
Right. Well, so I think one of the differences in the way that we are going about our work is we're thinking about the challenges that that people have, both in terms of the people who are stuck and need to find a better way, but also there's a business problem. And the business problem is that services businesses like retail, they rely on a workforce that is fairly low wage to be their primary interface with customers. And so if they can't find a way to keep people engaged on that job, then they're not going to have people engaging with their customers. So we've identified a business problem that's associated with this same problem of people getting stuck at these entry wages and not being able to see light at the end of a tunnel. Again, the one of the concepts of people not necessarily needing to advance along a straight line is there may or may not be opportunities to advance within that company. We are seeing about a third of our folks get internal promotions in the first 4 to 6 months of our work with them. So clearly there is a lot of promotion that does happen inside. But the fact is that a lot of folks are going to need to move to other companies in order to and other industries in order to pursue their aspirations. And what we've found is that when a company supports that career work by an individual, that what they get is a much more engaged employee and a much better relationship between the employee and the manager who's now supporting the career development of their worker. And as it turns out, we're seeing people stay in their jobs and stay at those companies a lot longer than they would without our program. So we're actually reducing turnover at the same time that we're helping people advance their careers.
Do the employers pay for the service?
They do. And the ultimate model is that we're not a philanthropically supported organization, but we're a business supported organization because we've found that sweet spot between how a worker will benefit from participating and how a business will benefit from participating.
Do they also provide time for the employee to participate?
Our work is all done on paid time. And we really believe that one of the keys to making this successful is that the company send the message to their employees that you are valuable to us and that your development is important to us. And whether you choose to pursue your career here or whether you choose to pursue your career elsewhere, that you are valuable. And so we're going to cover your time to participate in this program.
Thinking about career maps, what was it about your career that made you feel successful that brought you to this work?
Well, for me, it is this work is all about hope. And I personally went through some times early in my life where I had trouble seeing light at the end of a tunnel. And I managed to work my way out of it. But when I started my career and started working with young people in a low-income community, and I saw the looks on their faces of, why should I stay in school? Or why should I go and take this job? And because they didn't see light at the end of a tunnel, I recognized the look on their faces, and I said, you know, there has to be a way to tap into what people most want, and that's what I was able to do to work myself out of the situation that I was in, and it is a real thrill to watch that happen in a client in our program.
What makes an employer a good candidate for Springboard Forward? How would you target your prospects?
Well, you know, the idea that companies rely on their employees to be service-oriented, both service inside a company and service externally, like in a retail environment, that's a universal. And that if you can't, as a company, figure out a way to keep people engaged and really to enjoy the work that they do, then you're not going to get the kind of productivity that you need to be competitive. So we don't think that there are industries out there that wouldn't benefit. We have specifically targeted industries where people tend to get stuck at fairly low wages. And so that's retail, hospitality, healthcare.
Where are you currently operating?
We just expanded in the last year from two counties in the San Francisco Bay Area to region wide. So we are now serving businesses in all five of the major Bay Area counties, San Francisco Bay Area, and we are now looking for our first replication site, and we're looking at a number of opportunities around the country.
You are completing a three-year initiative to establish the direct link between what you've been describing, you call it an engaged employment program, and business profitability. What have you learned to date?
Well, it's been the most exciting part of our work, I think, is that we have proven that there is a return on investment for companies to hire us. And there's a lot of national conversation about the idea of corporate social responsibility, and I think that's wonderful, but I worry that it's not sustainable, because as companies go through hard times, as they are now, one of the first things that gets cut are programs like corporate social responsibility. So we have taken the approach that we need to be integral to the competitiveness of a company. And the last 3 years, we have seen the results that back that up. We've seen a significant reduction in turnover. We're seeing internal promotions. We're seeing relationships between managers and employees get significantly better, and their engagement on the job and their productivity getting better. So we are now ready to take this across the country. We're looking, our next step is a scalable, visible demonstration in a new site. And we're looking at a couple different sites across the country where we would do that. And it's going to need to be big enough that people take notice. And where we go from there, we'll have to see. But I think first we have to get people's attention with the model. So I think ultimately, you know, we want to move the needle. And I don't think you can do that by yourself. So the hope is that ultimately there's an industry that rises up out of this kind of idea, and that we're one of the players, and maybe we're the leader. But this has to be much bigger. I'll tell you, the model that I like the most is the Weight Watchers model. That the Weight Watchers model, you know, you if you want to lose weight in this country, you can go online and you can do it yourself. You can get a coach. You can be part of a group. And it's massive, and you can, you know, buy their food in the frozen section. But if you're stuck in your career, there's really nothing out there. So we're going to try to create it.
Elliot, thanks so much for being our guest on Smart City.
Okay, thank you.
Elliot Brown is the founder and executive director of Springboard Forward. For more information on the excellent work they're doing, head to our website, smartcityradio.com. Finally this week, context is everything. This week, our City Views commentator Walker Smith explores how small external cues can affect everything from the stock market to your dinner table.
Apparently, colors matter. A study just published online at the website for Science Magazine found that cognitive performance for tasks performed on a computer varied as a function of the background color of the computer screen. Red was a better background color if the task involved recall or attention to detail. Blue was better if the task required creativity and imagination. These colors are a part of the context within which decisions are made, and apparently, context matters a lot. We like to think of ourselves as autonomous beings, capable of abstracting ourselves from our surroundings and influences to make perfectly rational decisions and choices. Unfortunately, it never works that way in real life. The best example I know of how context matters is the work by Cornell social psychologist Brian Wansink that was published in a book called Mindless Eating. Wansink has built his career studying the ways in which situational elements exert a determining influence on our food and eating choices. He illustrates it in several fascinating ways at his website, mindlesseating.org. Plate size, serving size, the shape of a glass or a spoon, the presence or absence of certain aromas, whether the TV is on or off, and more, all exert a strong yet unconscious influence on the food choices that we make. I guess I'm stuck on this notion of context because I have always struggled with the idea of an unfettered, unmediated, perfectly free personal choice, especially when it comes to things like advertising and marketing. The whole practice of marketing is built on the presumption that choices can indeed be managed, shaped, and influenced by changes in context. I don't know what the philosophical, legal, or moral implications of this might be. I just know that when it comes to what I do, it is taken for granted that within a certain degree of probability, a probability that can be measured, people can be induced to choose one thing instead of another. And it's not always about changing attitudes first through some rational process of decision-making. Most of marketing is focused only on changing behaviors. Attitudes don't even enter into the equation. Simply put, context matters. And if we expect consumers to be able to handle, much less resist, the pull and power of context and the ways in which it can be manipulated, then they will need more than just their own wits and willpower, because that's exactly what marketers know how to overwhelm. Except maybe in this recession, where the overarching context is rapidly turning into one of no money to buy. But we're hopeful that the stimulus package is going to fix that, and then we'll be right back to this issue of whether people really are the free agents that free markets presume, or whether we need to reconsider what empowerment and proper protections and regulations should really be about. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is the president of the Yankelovich Monitor, a trend service of the Futures Group. He joins us each week from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. That's all for this week's show, but there's more Smart City on our website. Head to smartcityradio.com and subscribe to our podcast, read my blog, or sign up for our newsletter. You can also reach us by clicking the contact button or by following me on Twitter at @ccoletta. Smart City's web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities, and national distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee and its citizens. For more information, visit hydefoundations.org. Scotty Iseri is our swashbuckling producer and engineer. I'm Carol Coletta.